Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about Afghanistan and the elections that took place there over this past weekend. And our guest for the program is David Edwards. He's professor of anthropology at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. And he has been for some time now been following Afghan politics and studying Afghan history and writing about it. He is the author of a recent book titled Before Taliban, Genealogies of the Afghan Jihad. That was published by the University of California Press in 2008. And two. He's joining us this morning by telephone to talk. And as we do, of course, questions from listeners are welcome. If you'd like to be a part of the program, you just pick up the telephone and call us. If you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. Calls are certainly welcome. We just ask people to be brief. Brief as possible, just so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep things moving. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Professor Edwards, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for being with us again.
My pleasure.
We really appreciate it. Well, as people heard, if they were just listening to the newscast, obviously we know that it'll be some time before there is an official result in the election. However, I guess now we have exit polling everywhere, and even in Afghanistan, and the initial indications are that the leader in the polling is President Karzai, who was acknowledged to be the front runner in the beginning. So that's not particularly a surprise. There have been questions raised about the process. Initially, a number of candidates, in fact, I think almost all of them except Mr. Karzai, said the election should be stopped, it should be done over, and now I think most of them have modified that comment somewhat and said that they, at the very least, they think that there should be an investigation into how it was conducted. But having said all that, I guess I wonder what you think is ultimately going to be the outcome, and do you think that Mr. Karzai will end up being a clear winner?
I think there's little doubt that he's going to win. The one question is whether he's going to get the 50% majority that he needs to win outright, or whether there'll have to be a final referendum in later in November. That's up in the air. I think the main thing that that everybody has hoped would come out of this election, the assumption has been from the beginning that Karzai would be the victor, but the main goal of the process has been to provide legitimacy for his government. And that's the real stake in this. And they have formed an independent commission to investigate the allegations of fraud and of multiple registrations, the problem with the ink that emerged during on election day. And the commission is meeting now, and they will begin the counting as soon as that process is complete.
So do you have any feeling about that issue of legitimacy, about how this election was carried out?
Well, there are several stages. The first stage was the registration process. I spent last fall in Kabul, and so I watched the beginning of the registration process, and it was really astounded by how successful it ultimately turned out to be. In the first month, they were getting 60 and 70 people registering at registration stations. It was a pathetic result. And so when they ended up by election time of registering 10.5 million people, it was astounding and indicated, I think, both that there was some success in the process, but also there were clear indications of illegitimacy in how it was carried out, not by the people who were conducting the registration, by people who were manipulating the process. There were cases, particularly along the border provinces, the provinces bordering Pakistan, which are majority Pashtun, and also the area where the Taliban has been most powerful and where the government has least control. And in those areas, you had registration that was so high that the UN actually had to up its estimate of the population, because the number of people who were registered exceeded the population estimates. So there were clearly indications that people were registering multiple times. And there could be a variety of reasons for that. The prospect of selling their registration cards, the prospect of being able to vote multiple times for their candidate. So there were indications early on that there were problems with the registration, but I think that while that's significant, it should also not mask the fact that there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm by Afghans for the process.
Hmm. Well, given that, you know, I think that a lot of people would acknowledge the fact that, yes, all the way along there have been problems, but also given the fact that the turnout was very high and there were a significant numbers of women who said they were interested in having a voice, I think some people would say the fact that it happened at all and the way that it happened and that there was not a lot of violence, all of those things added together, you would have to say that just on that basis, that it was a success.
I think that's true. I think it's there was a high participation of women. That can mean a lot of things. It shouldn't be assumed that women are necessarily acting as independent operators in this. Their votes may be determined by their husbands or fathers, but nevertheless, there was a high turnout, and there was everybody who witnessed the actual election was struck by the enthusiasm, the willingness of Afghans to wait in long lines to be part of this process. So I think that is by itself a very hopeful sign.
Hmm. What, assuming that the result is as we suspect and Mr. Karzai wins, there are other candidates, and some of them I'm sure would get significant numbers of votes, particularly Yunus Kanuni, who was the person who before the polling was acknowledged to be the second guy behind Mr. Karzai, and in fact he at one point was a part of Mr. Karzai's government. Are there other people who have enough standing or enough support so that we would expect that they would have a claim to be involved in the next Afghan government?
Well, I think the short answer is nobody else. The Kanuni is the only candidate who could actually anybody expects. If Karzai does not get an outright majority, he would be the person who interrupted that. Hmm. But I don't even think that's going to happen. I think that Karzai will probably get an outright majority. But Kanuni is an interesting character. He was a former minister of education under Karzai in this first Northern Alliance government that was put together. He broke with Karzai in part because of ethnic politics in Afghanistan. There was a sense that the alliance of Panjshiris, these are Tajiks who were associated with Commander Ahmad Shah Massoud, the famous commander from Panjshir Valley who was killed 2 days before 9/11 by al-Qaeda. And he is the most significant political figure in the country in the sense as a political symbol. You still see his picture all over Kabul, large posters, and in both in government-sponsored posters and in individual shops. He's a very popular symbol for the Afghan resistance, for the years of suffering and struggle that they went through against the Soviet Union. So there were a whole lot of people who were lesser figures who had surrounded themselves, who had surrounded Massoud and tried to gain some part of his legacy, and Kanuni is one of those. And there was a thought that last summer, Karzai dismissed the Minister of Education, who's another one of these people from Panjshir, and that this was an indication that he was going to sideline them, that he was moving increasingly toward a Pashtun alliance and moving further away from the Tajiks. And so Kanuni tried to pull together a coalition that included these sidelined Panjshiris, Tajiks, in order to create basically an ethnic coalition to counter Karzai's move more toward Pashtuns.
Hmm. And this is, if people remember back to the war, to the U.S. Invasion and the attempt to get rid of the Taliban, these people you're talking about from the Panjshir, these were the people that generally get referred to as the Northern Alliance.
Exactly.
Right. Here, I guess that points to one of the difficulties of Afghanistan is that there are a number of ethnic groups. The biggest are the Pashtun, and Mr. Karzai is a Pashtun. And then the next biggest are the Tajik, and Mr. Kanuni is Tajik. And then we have others like the Hazara and the Uzbeks, and another leading name, General Abdul Rashid Dostum. He is an Uzbek. So I guess the question that I'm getting at is, when you have a nation like this that is made up of distinct ethnic groups that have been in conflict in the past, can you really think about the idea of developing a kind of a national consciousness, a real sense that above and beyond being Pashtun or Tajik or Uzbek or anything else, and there are others, that one is an Afghan?
I think you can. It's a good question, and I think it's in fact the question that Afghanistan has to address in the next decade. There are very strong local allegiances and ethnic alliances. They became more strong during the war against the Soviet Union because each of those areas became more independent, autonomous from the central government, more dependent upon each other. Ethnic groups that had not been armed became armed during that time. They became political powers in their own right. So the situation now is very different than it was, say, in 1977 before the communist coup. And that is going to affect electoral politics as it redevelops in Afghanistan. At the same time, I think there is a very strong sense of national consciousness. I think Afghans, they think of their country as separate. They are afraid of the consequences of the central government collapsing. Even though there are Uzbeks, take the example of Uzbeks in the northern part of the country, there is an Uzbekistan right across the border and to the north of Afghanistan. Some people might assume that they would want to have an alliance with those Uzbeks in Uzbekistan, but I think that's not the case at all. In fact, they realize that they would be swallowed up in any kind of fragmentation of the country. And I think the same is true of other ethnic groups, that they realize that their best chance is in a independent Afghan state.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is David Edwards. He's an anthropologist. He's a professor at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and has for some time now been studying Afghanistan and its history and its politics. And we're talking about the country, about the recent election, and questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to bring into the conversation on our line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to know what percentage of the overall vote will come from the Kabul area.
That's difficult to say right now. The election monitors who were in place, there were not very many international monitors, but there were quite a few domestic monitors. They were mostly in the Kabul area. That's one of the difficulties of talking about Afghanistan and really of trying to institute electoral politics there, is that there are not good census figures. We don't know the relative populations of the country. A lot of during the war years of the 80s, 3.2 million Afghans were refugees in Pakistan. Another 2 million were refugees in Iran. A lot of those people have returned to Afghanistan, but many of them have gone to Kabul. I lived in Kabul in the 1970s, and at that time there were 600,000 people there. Now there are probably more than 3 million. And many of those people are displaced, internally displaced people who, for one reason or another, couldn't go back to their rural home districts, so they've gone to Kabul to try to earn money as migrant laborers. So it's very difficult to talk about demographics with any kind of concreteness, and I think this is going to become particularly important during the scheduled next round of elections in the spring when the parliament is supposed to be elected. Right now, there's a lot of conflict over the boundary lines between districts, about the number of districts that are allocated to Pashtuns versus Tajiks and other groups. And without clear census figures, it's going to be difficult to be able to put those controversies to rest.
I just wondered because apparently the Kabul area is the most secure area, and many of the other areas are not that secure. Is that correct?
That's right. And the reason is because since 2002, and their International Security Assistance Force has been operating in Kabul, about 7,000 troops from now led by NATO, a multinational troop. I spent last fall several weeks with the ISAF peacekeepers, and they are doing a very effective job patrolling the streets of Kabul, and which is a very important element of the whole equation in Afghanistan. Probably the worst period in Afghan history from the point of view of particularly of people from Kabul, but for the whole country, was the early 90s. It was after the communist government had collapsed. The resistance parties, the Mujahideen parties, had all come into Kabul and claimed different neighborhoods and high ground, the mountains that are surround and in the middle of the city. Different groups occupied these points, and when they couldn't agree on succession and couldn't agree on the way in which power was going to be distributed, they start firing at each other, and whole neighborhoods were razed to the ground. And Afghans remember that period as the worst period of their history, in part because these people that they had great hopes for, these resistance fighters who had led the struggle against the Soviet Union, when given power on their own, had turned on each other. So it was a disastrous time, and no one wants to see that happen again. So the presence of international security forces on the streets are a source of great confidence building for the Afghans.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, just to carry that on a point further, and you've spoken to this a little bit already, I guess I'm interested in the perception that people often seem to have or articulate that what constitutes the government of Afghanistan, if we're talking in terms of a central government, is really limited to Kabul, and that the further outside of the capital you get, the less kind of control the government has, and you more and more end up with independent operators here and there, the people who are referred to as warlords, who have their own military forces, who are who have their own interests at heart, and don't particularly feel beholden to the central government. I mean, how close to the truth is that?
Well, I think it is true. The government has been unable, and it's a massive task, and it shouldn't be underestimated. I don't think you can say it's an outright failure. It's partially a reflection of the complexity of the country and its long history. But it's true that Karzai, his power dissipates the further away he gets from Kabul and a few other cities. Now, a few things have emerged. A few events have happened recently to indicate that they are trying to push central government, the power of the central government, further into the countryside. One happened this summer when I was in Kabul, when there was a local so-called warlord, a term that I have some trouble with, but we'll use it for that right now. A local warlord in Herat province, in the western part of the country, was in a dispute with Ismail Khan, the governor of Herat, who was also a very powerful warlord in his own right. And the central government used that as an opportunity to send in its own troops and basically to take Ismail Khan out of power and to put their own man in charge of Herat. So that was a particularly contentious one because Ismail Khan had been there in Herat since the beginning of the fight against the Soviet Union. He's locally a popular figure, but he's very independent. And he also controls a lot of the revenues that come from border trade between Iran and Afghanistan. It's one of the biggest places where tax revenues come in. And he was keeping most of those tax revenues for himself instead of sending them to the central government. The central government wanted to get their hands both on Herat and on those tax revenues. And so it was an indication of that the government was going to take a more active role in trying to implant central government authority in areas that had previously been independent. Now, whether that continues in other parts of the country remains to be seen.
Let's talk with another caller. This listener is in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Two questions. I'm hoping it's a sensible one. What are the positions of the two leading contestants? Do they even have positions, or is it just ethnic against ethnic? And secondly, it's almost begging the question. I mean, the man that's in Kabul, placed there by the Bush administration, has the military to keep him there. Is that normally when we have voting in those kinds of situations, doesn't the man who has the military guarding him and making sure that nobody does anything usually wins?
Let me take the first question first about the positions of the two leading candidates, Karzai and Kanuni. One of the difficulties, one of the drawbacks of the process was there was not a great deal of campaigning. The campaign period itself was limited to a month, and during that time, There were campaign rallies in Kabul and a few other cities, but there wasn't the candidates didn't have the ability to get out into the countryside where most of the people live. And because there also isn't the same kind of media saturation that we have in the West, the media events that took place in Kabul were not widely seen outside of the city. So the campaign itself was something of a sham. One of the major things that Karzai himself has promised, and we'll see whether he can deliver on it, I think it's a very important thing if he can, and that is that right now the ministries, there are a number of ministries, too many ministries in Kabul, that exercise the role of governance. And right now, many of those ministries are effectively ethnic enclaves. They are the entitlements of particular ethnic groups, so that when one minister resigns for one reason or another, he's replaced by somebody from his same ethnic group, whether he's competent or not. And one thing that Karzai has promised is that he will both eliminate many of the non-functioning ministries, the redundant ministries, and he will put at their tops people in the leadership roles, people who are competent technocratically to administer, who have experience in administration. And if he has a clear outright majority, I think he will be in a position to do that. If he has a marginal victory, then he's going to have to play more politics and bring people into his coalition to be able to effectively govern. One worry in that regard, too, is what happens when the parliamentary elections take place. Is there going to have to be more of this kind of deal-making going on? The second question, could you remind me of the second
question? Well, I think the second question essentially was, look at the relationship between Mr. Karzai and the United States. And would
right.
Mr. Karzai been
right.
in the position that he is without the support of the United States? And I guess on that, I would add a question about how people in Afghanistan perceive him, and do they see him as being America's man?
They do. And he is, and I think the original question that the caller asked about is it really fair, and when you have such a disproportionate amount of power in the hands of the incumbent, and I think that it's a good question. I think the answer is no, it really isn't fair, and that's one of the complaints that a lot of the candidates had about the whole campaign period of a month before the election. Karzai had the ability to go to campaign rallies in helicopters provided by the United States. Other candidates didn't have that. He had security people surrounding him. Now, that's good and bad because the security people are Americans. And one of the sources of greatest animosity right now, and really bitterness in Afghanistan that I noticed, was the resentment about these private contractors who are the bodyguards of Karzai, and who are also the bodyguards to Zomai Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador, and other high-ranking officials. These private contractors, we came into the news after the scandals at Abu Ghraib in Iraq, and we don't have anything of that magnitude, or at least we don't have the photographic evidence of anything of that magnitude in Afghanistan, although there are rumors about similar kinds of incidents. But there is a great deal of animosity about the role of these contractors, and I've seen it with my own eyes where when, the ambassador or the deputy ambassador goes through the city in a convoy of Humvees, these contractors will get out and go into the intersections and point their guns in drivers' faces, and they have no, they're very brutal and disrespectful of the Afghans. They have a job to do, of course, but the way that they conduct themselves is often creates tremendous animosity. And in August, when I was in Kabul, there was a major car bomb. The only real major act of planned violence of this sort that happened in the run-up to the election, which was remarkable fact in itself. But this was targeted at Dyncor, one of the security companies, the major security company that operates in Kabul. And the Taliban took responsibility for this car bomb. 9 people were killed. It was a very carefully planned, orchestrated operation. But I happened to be close by when it happened, and I was talking to people on the street, watching these bystanders who were watching as the flames were coming up from the explosion, and they were not talking about the Taliban, who they assumed already at that point, even before they'd taken responsibility, they assumed this was a Taliban operation, but they weren't talking about the Taliban. What they were talking about were security contractors, about how much they disliked these people. So it was a very well chosen target by the Taliban, because it ended up deflecting attention from themselves and actually put attention on this company that was creating a lot of animosity in the city.
We are a little bit past the midpoint. Let me again introduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with David Edwards. He's professor of anthropology at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and has done a lot of writing and research on Afghanistan and its history and its politics. His recent book is titled Before Taliban, Genealogies of the Afghan Jihad. It's published by University of California Press and came out in 2002. And questions are welcome here on the show, 333-9455, also toll-free, 800-222-9455. Before the election, if you read the coverage, there were predictions that the Taliban would make efforts to use violence to disrupt the process, and it really didn't happen. If you read the coverage now, indeed there are quotes from people like this one, for example, from Lieutenant General David Barno, who's the commander of U.S. troops there. He said, speaking of the election, he said, it was a huge defeat for the Taliban. The Taliban didn't show. What do you make of this, and what can we say now about the Taliban and what sort of influence it has in Afghan politics?
Well, it's a good question, and I think it's a question a lot of people are asking themselves right now, because everybody in the international community in Kabul in September when I left was assuming that they were basically battening down the hatches, assuming that there was going to be a lot of violence. And this one car bomb that I mentioned, everybody thought was the precursor to a wave of violence that was going to strike. In fact, it didn't happen. Now, having said that, it shouldn't be discounted, the fact that there was a lot of violence. There, a lot of registration officials were, a number were killed. I think in the neighborhood of a dozen were killed during the summer and since the spring. There a number of schools have been torched. There was a girls' school about the same time that this car bomb happened. There was a girls' school that was bombed. 12 girls were killed. So there is violence of different sorts, and some of it targeted against the election process. Some of it targeted other symbols of government power, government authority. I think it is remarkable and something of a mystery that it didn't happen as planned in regard to the election. I think is partially a sign that the International Security Assistance Force did a good job. I get security alerts from the non-governmental organization security office in Kabul, and a number of times in the prelude to the election, there were indications that they had stopped suspected people with explosives in their vehicles. So I think that there was good work done by the security people. But I don't think that entirely explains it, because they didn't have much reach outside of Kabul itself. Did the Taliban decide that it would be unpopular to target the election? I don't know. I don't think anybody really has a clear beat on that one yet.
We have some other callers here. We'll get to them in the order they came in. So next up is Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Your comment on DynCorp provokes me to ask a question about that. I mean, what sort of complaints do they have? Because they're all over the place. Obviously, they're in Iraq, they're in Colombia, they're in Kosovo and the Balkans, where they actually, a couple of them are actually being sued for trafficking in women or something like that. Some of the operatives of DynCorp, it's a really shady outfit, it seems to me. And I guess there's more security contractors in Iraq than people from Missouri, as was illustrated the other day. But I just wonder how many of the people are there. But I actually wanted to call and ask about the Human Rights Watch report I'm wondering if you're familiar with that. I don't know, maybe you've contributed to it because it was released in September. There's very little comment on it. I've been searching through the New York Times periodically and looking up Human Rights Watch, and there's no, as far as I can tell, there was no particular reference to Human Rights Watch's report on Afghanistan. It's called The Rule of the Gun, Human Rights Abuses, Political Repression in the Run-Up to Afghanistan's Presidential Election. And it goes into some great detail about not just the Taliban, but, I mean, violence is one thing. Intimidation is a use of violence without actually blowing any bombs up. And I don't know, the warlords, drug lords, I don't know why you have a particular, I mean, obviously it ropes a lot of people into a narrow category, but, you know, you have to be able to generalize in some ways. And not all warlords are drug lords, but a lot of them are. And they're the people that I think that were intimidating and commissioning people to register more than several times, et cetera, et cetera. From their own point of view, they probably can justify it because they see Karzai being flown around in Black Hawk helicopters by the U.S., which is a rather big in-kind donation, I would guess. So I would like for you to react to some of those points.
Okay. On the last point about warlords, the reason I have trouble with it is I think that it wipes a whole category of people with one brush, and I think there are different reasons why some of these regional commanders have power. The central government has not been a reliable player, has not been a reliable authority over the last 30 years, and so there have become regional alliances, and some of those people are drug lords and warlords and human rights abusers, as you indicate. That's absolutely true, and I don't want to try to, my point is not to whitewash that. It's simply to say that I think sometimes you need to make fine distinctions between why in power as opposed to another, and when you call all of them warlords, it becomes difficult to make those kinds of distinctions. So that's the point on that. With regard to DynCorp, matter of fact, I heard this morning on NPR that DynCorp is also one of the organizations, one of the military contractors who, traditional military contractors, who's also trying to bid for some of the funds that are associated with the eradication of AIDS, which is something of a scary thought if you've seen DynCorp operating in Kabul and other places. I think the problem is that they are, for one thing, they're giving the American government a bad name, the American people a bad name. Afghans are not always able to distinguish between military and these private contractors because they seem to have similar authority, even though they don't dress the same. The military, I think, in Afghanistan, there have been mistakes made. There have been casualties that are a result of miscalculations or bad intelligence by the military. But the military, by and large, conducts themselves with professionalism, and they also have a code of conduct that controls their behavior. The DynCorp people, a lot of them come across as cowboys, and they, I've been in restaurants where they come in, they have their weapons, often a pistol and a big automatic weapon. They have their Oakley sunglasses. They conduct themselves like, I mean, it's the closest analogy I can make is the Wild West, where these cowboys come in from the range, and they don't have any concept of Afghan culture or the importance of trying to show respect to the people in that culture. Afghans are very, very sensitive about the role of outsiders in their country, and if you become seen as an invader, that's the kiss of death. And I think that also is one of the problems, that Karzai is surrounded by these people, and some people are beginning to think of Karzai as a puppet of the American government. And if you look at Afghan history, the periods, the people going back to the 19th century, Shah Shuja in the 1830s and 40s, was installed on the throne of Kabul by the British government, and he never was able to gain legitimacy for himself because he was considered to be a British puppet. Same thing with Babrak Karmal, the person who was installed after the Soviet invasion in 1979. It undercut his credibility with the Afghan people, and he never was able to really get traction. I think that danger exists for Karzai as well, along the same lines.
As far as being a puppet, we have his viceroy, Khalilzad, Well, I guess he was a co-worker with in the past in various corporate interests and governmental interests too.
That's right.
And the idea that he's going around and doing being political fixer, discourage people from running, offering them some kind of position in the new government, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I don't know why people can take it seriously. It's, to me, it is it's clearly a puppet government, the enthusiasm is consequently, to me, is that by the Afghan people is pretty sad. I feel pretty sad about it because I think they're hoping against hope, and they don't have much else. So
that's right. But I think you have to look at it from their point of view. Karzai, there's no doubt that he is that the person who's pulling the strings is the ambassador, and it's interesting. We might want to discuss this in a second, but it's interesting that the U.S. ambassador in Kabul is a native-born Afghan, speaks the native languages, knows all the personalities, and is able to interact with them in a way that no other U.S. ambassador, to my knowledge, has ever behaved. And so he's not even he's called frequently referred to as a viceroy along the British lines, but in fact he's something even more interesting than that, because he is an inside player, and he's been using his power in ways that I think are so blatant that they have unintentionally served to undermine Karzai's power. But getting back to my main point, and that is that from the point of view of Afghans, for all of Karzai's faults, he's not a Saddam Hussein. He's not a despot. If anything, his problem is that he's ineffectual, that he's not decisive. But he is also not somebody himself who has been accused of human rights abuses or of political crimes. And given the history of that country, however limited his power is and however limited his effectiveness, there is a stability, a calm in Afghanistan that didn't exist before. And I think that people appreciate that, and they want to build on that. So I think the enthusiasm is for a process. It may be, and there may be a pathetic quality to it, a hope against reason quality to it, but it shouldn't be discounted that they need to hold on to something. And for them, look at the alternative. If this election process, as illegitimate as it might be by Western standards, if it fails, what are the consequences? And I think that's what Afghans are worried about.
We have some other callers. We're moving into our last 15 minutes here on Focus in this first hour. Our guest, David Edwards, he's professor of anthropology at Williams College. We're talking about Afghanistan. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next callers are here in Urbana. Next is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I cannot see any reason to disagree with Professor Edwards or with people who called. It is a good picture of Afghanistan. But sometimes, as Ronald Reagan said, you just have to hold your nose and kiss the skunk. But things are bad. You know, the process was corrupt. The constitution is corrupt. Zalmay is our ambassador in Afghanistan. But Karzai is perceived to be a decent person. However, as Professor Edward knows, Afghanistan is now, if the U.S. leaves, is very, very soon is going to degenerate into ethnic politics and become a sort of, if you could call it, ethnic democracy. Now, what I think the U.S. has to do is to be patient and see if this democracy takes, by that I mean if it takes root, ultimately. What I'm impressed is, in fact, by the Afghan people's courage, that against all odds, they went en masse and voted. And so far, the new United Nations appointed committee of two, a Swede and a Canadian, isolated, I think, about 40 ballot boxes, which come probably no more than 50,000 votes that they are going to look at it. And they permitted counting of all other votes to resume. So I'm very, very hopeful. What I'm not quite confident if the U.S. has the determination to stay and see this democracy take root. And one short comment about Ismail Khan. Ismail Khan, of course, got the revenue, but there was not really a government to send the revenue to, because the government of Karzai was so small and it wasn't really gelled yet and was corrupt and is corrupt. So the money that he got from the customs from Turkmenistan, Iran, in fact, quite a lot of it, not all of it probably, but quite a lot of it was used to develop Herat. And Herat is the only area of Afghanistan that has a school, paved road, electricity, among others. And there was peace until the central government engineered war with Amanullah and others that happened just recently, and Ismail Khan was set aside. Thank you, Dr. Edwards, for coming.
Oh, thanks for the call. I wonder, Professor Edwards, what you think about the point that the caller makes, particularly about the question he raises about the long-term commitment of the United States to Afghanistan.
Well, that's one thing that Afghans in general worry tremendously about. I think there is an assumption that America is not going to stay the course, and they look to history to for evidence of that. After the Soviets pulled out in 1989, we had supported the resistance parties. We had basically not only armed them, we'd financed them, we had created them. People who had not existed before were really put into positions of power with American money. And when the Soviets left, we lost interest. And that's when Afghans say, why did everything dissolve? It was partially because the people who had the outside brokers who had played a role in the early days failed to live up to their responsibilities in the post-Soviet period. And I think the same thing is feared now, that when the election is over, the American election, when there's less reason, particularly now with the massive commitment of troops in Iraq, that there's a worry that we're gonna cut and run. And I think that, in fact, even from the very beginning, from December 2001, when bin Laden was in Tora Bora, we decided to not use American troops. We decided to save those troops and to depend on Afghan proxies. And I think that set the pattern from that point on, that our attention really was toward gearing up for Iraq. And Afghanistan, from the point of view of the administration, has always been a sideshow. And I think it's a shame, because Afghanistan offered an opportunity for a real victory, not only a victory against the Taliban and al-Qaeda, victory that's been elusive so far, but a victory for America in its relationship with a Middle East country. There was probably no Muslim country in the world that was as receptive and as ready to work with America. And I think if we had stayed engaged in Afghanistan in a way we have not, we could now, the Bush administration could now point to Afghanistan as a real victory, as a solid foundation economically, politically for a stable civil society. And now they're saying it, the rhetoric is there, but the reality is that we have not engaged, we have not put the money in that we promised, nor have other donor countries as well. The promises made in the enthusiasm of early 2002 faded, other commitments came along, and we forgot about Afghanistan, and I think we let a major victory slip out of our grasp.
Let's go again to another caller. This is someone also in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hi. We have family who were Peace Corps volunteers in Afghanistan in the mid-60s, and continue to be keeping in touch with Afghans that they're able to, and including emigres who would like to go back. And they themselves are volunteering to help with writing some new legal code for the environment for Afghanistan. We were with them this weekend, and they had some interesting comments to make, one of which was that Afghanistan used to have a major export to India of raisins and nuts, and they've lost it now because now India imports from California those products, and Afghanistan can't meet California's prices on these things, which I thought was kind of a sad twist. Good for California farmers, terrible for Afghan farmers. And they were also saying that essentially the major, there are two major industries in Afghanistan, it seems. One is building, because a lot of people are trying to move into the cities where it's safer and people are coming back to the country. But the other one is drugs.
That's right.
And that the drugs, there's so much money in raising heroin, I presume that's what the drug is, that it leads to corruption, and it's really, really difficult for anybody to make headway, including the people who have good intentions and want to see good things happen to the country. It's really, really hard for them to make any headway with the pervasive amount of corruption as a result of the drugs.
Yeah. Let me make a comment about the Peace Corps first and then talk about drugs, but I think it's one of the things that I find sad now is that the kind of ways in which the multiple ways that America was able to engage with the rest of the world that during the Cold War period are not happening now. You don't find Peace Corps, you don't even find the Foreign Service Officer stationed in Kabul able to leave their embassy. They live in, you have to get into the embassy. It's like the Green Zone, a small version of the Green Zone in Baghdad. You have to go through multiple layers of security, and you finally get inside, and you find all the personnel living in containers on the grounds of the embassy. It's like Fort Apache, a modern version of Fort Apache, and they're totally cut off from Afghans, the people that they're supposed to be helping and trying to understand. The only people who are really able to engage Afghans these days, or who are willing to, are the military officers. They're out there in the villages and working in the ministries. They're the real operators. The Foreign Service and other civilian sides of American involvement in Afghanistan. I think it's true of other countries as well, but the civilian side is gone, and I think it's a sad thing, and it's something that we need to be thinking about in terms of how we present ourselves and what our role is in the rest of the world.
She also had an interesting comment back in August, and she said that for her, as somebody who had lived in Afghanistan, I think she was talking about images of Iraq. It could have been of Afghanistan, but in some respects, I think there's continuity. She said that one of the most disturbing images, and she was moved practically to tears about this, she said, was seeing our army go in and bash down doors of residences and drag people out, including the women. And she said, and I remember seeing these, I didn't understand. And she said, at the time, I didn't understand what this would mean to somebody who was living in those cultures. She said the sense of privacy and that you don't go into somebody's home and you don't deal with somebody, the women in the family, it's deeply insulting and shows a total lack of understanding and respect for somebody else's culture.
That's
and I
right.
was thinking, too, about, again, this goes over to Iraq, I don't condone at all this taking of hostages and chopping off their heads in order to get women released, but I think that we, in our treatment of prisoners in Abu Ghraib, or however you pronounce it, I would be worried, if I were from that culture, I'd be worried about how our army was treating the women, if they're treating the men like this, given everything else one knows about how women have been treated in other cultures. They're worried. We seem to have set ourselves up for major misunderstandings and for creating more enemies than we're killing.
That's right, and I think that it stems from a pervasive or that were really the people stationed in Afghanistan. A lot of these troops, I feel for them in a way, because they're in a position where they have no access to the culture. They don't really know what they're dealing with, and all the stories that they've been told lead them to suspect that everybody is a Taliban. Everybody is an enemy, and so they behave accordingly. And the results are, as you say, are devastating. And imagine, I mean, part of it's Afghan culture and their very strong sense of privacy and the separation of the private domestic sphere from the public sphere. But it's also human nature too. I mean, any of us would have that response if a military force of another country came in and knocked down our front door and started searching us. That's something that we can all relate to.
We're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. My apologies. We have a couple of people we can't take. We'll simply have to leave it there, but I'm sure that in future we'll be talking about Afghanistan again. So you can look forward to that. And again, I want to thank our guest, David Edwards. He's professor of anthropology at Williams College, Williamstown, Massachusetts. And Professor Edwards, thank you very much for talking
to us. Thank you, David.